from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. The Bay Area caught a break today for the first time in over a week. It's not a spare the air day. So far this season, we've had 22 such days, a record-breaking pace. Coming up on Forum, we're going to explore what's going on with that trend and what the air quality prospects are for the coming weeks. And this winter, not only do we have to worry about the atmosphere that surrounds us, we have to worry about the water that doesn't. No rain in October, precious little in November, none in December. In the hour ahead, spare the air and worries over water. Next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson, in today for Michael Krasny. The weather has been lovely recently, and that's the problem. Warm, balmy, rain-free days mean that spare-the-air days have been stacking up right alongside that firewood that you haven't been able to burn. Until today, that is, the first day that hasn't come with a spare-the-air designation in over a week. The bad air this winter has been caused by a high-pressure system that's blocked our usual winter storm pattern, which brings us to an equally scary prospect for the year ahead, and that's drought. Red flag warnings are in place this morning for parts of the East and South Bay, and some Sacramento area communities are already issuing mandatory water conservation measures. So this morning on Forum, we take up our air and water woes. Joining us to do that, Lisa Fasano, who's the spokesperson for the Bay Area Air District, which regulates stationary sources of air pollution in the counties surrounding the San Francisco Bay. Lisa, good morning.
Good morning.
Joining us, too, is Eric Stevenson, who's the Director of Measurement and Technical Services for the Bay Area District as well. Eric, good morning.
Good morning.
And joining us from Sacramento this morning, Janine Jones. She's the Interstate Resource Manager and Deputy Drought Manager for California Water Resources. Janine, good morning as well.
Good morning.
So let's do some good news, bad news. Lisa, starting out at least with the fact that for the first time in over a week, no spare-the-air warnings today.
That's correct, and we're pleased with that. We had breezes come in a little sooner than we expected yesterday, and it's helping to sort of clear out the region for today. So we are having much less polluted air today than we've had for the past week.
And Eric, that started yesterday with things starting to clear out a bit, which in some ways also points to the kind of imprecise nature of what you have to do, because probably by midday yesterday, even though it was a spare of the air day, it might not have had to be.
Well, I think you've made a good point, is that it's difficult for us to forecast, because we're looking at forecasting the weather and also forecasting atmospheric chemistry. So that makes it, you know, doubly difficult on those of us who have to do those forecasts. So yesterday the winds started a little bit earlier and they were a little bit stronger, which of course is great for air quality, but bad for the accuracy of our forecasts.
And now you are in the process of doing what in terms of assessing where we are for tomorrow?
Well, we begin looking at all sorts of information, from the National Weather Service, information from around the state as far as air quality goes. And then we try and determine, what the wind speeds are going to be like, when those winds are predicted to begin, and then lay on top of that what the concentrations of particulate matter are, not only in the Bay Area, but throughout the region and the state, looking at the Sacramento Valley, the San Joaquin Valley, and other areas in California, because we all share the same air over time.
So it's interconnected in that way. What do we know about tomorrow? When do you make that call? Things looking good? Things uncertain? Where are you?
Well, at this point, it's going to be a difficult forecast for us. Basically, what we're going to be looking at is how strong are the winds going to be, how strong is the inversion layer that kind of puts a cap at the height that the air mixes, And then we've also got to take a look at what the concentrations are in the Bay Area and outside the Bay Area.
So sort of 50-50 for Spare the Air tomorrow, Lisa?
Right. And we should have a forecast developed by between noon and 1 o'clock today. And so we'll be able to make that call.
We'll dig more into what goes into making that call and what the concerns are about air quality as we go through our program. But let's turn to the other news of the day, to Janine Jones at the California Department of Water Resources. Reading that there are already some communities, at least in the Sacramento area, making drought measurements mandatory. Tell us what's going on.
Well, not just in the Sacramento area, but throughout the state, some communities have been looking at the fact that we've had two dry years and are going into a third dry year and are starting to think about asking their customers for either voluntary or mandatory conservation. City of Sacramento, for example, has had outdoor watering restrictions that remain in place regardless, and in their case, they're emphasizing that these restrictions are in place and people are supposed to be following them.
There are also some red flag warnings posted in the Bay Area today, meaning, well, you tell us what it means, but as I understand it, sort of no open burning, and that is also because of the extremely dry conditions?
Red flag warnings relate to wildfire risk, and we have heightened risk of wildfires simply because it's been so dry for so long. And in fact, we've seen some record large wildfires, such as the Big Sur fire earlier this month, which you would typically not expect to be seeing in the wintertime.
We want to get a forecast, if we can, right now, and get a little bit more information about why we are having this problem with both air quality and drought. And joining us to give us a sort of snapshot view of that is John Monteverdi, who's a professor of meteorology in the Department of Earth and Climate Sciences at San Francisco State University. Professor Monteverdi, thanks for joining us.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. So tell us what's going on. I mean, when you look at this fact that we've had, until today at least, this sort of bad air hovering over the Bay Area, how connected is that to the fact that we also haven't any rain? Just give us the kind of meteorology 101 of this, if you would.
And I would add to that, that's coincident with, I'm certain by tomorrow, the driest year in the history of San Francisco. Since October, the storm track in the Pacific has been in a configuration that took most of the disturbances up through Alaska and then, as you've been reading in the news, into the midsection of the country. That's not that unusual. What normally happens occasionally with this kind of pattern is that we get another branch of the storm track that comes under that or south of that into California, and that has not been developing. As a result, we've had no precipitation essentially except for two events, one in early December and one in November.
And so with this high-pressure ridge sort of sitting over us, tell us what's going on with the winds that picked up that made the air at least seem visibly better yesterday. Is that fool's gold, or is that telling us that things are starting to change?
Actually, that's fool's gold. That was the result of a disturbance that moved through and east of us the other day, leaving behind what you described as surface high-pressure area. You know, around here in Oakland, about 10 o'clock in the morning yesterday, we started to get really strong northeast winds, and that's what some of your other speakers referred to. In terms of change, there are some hints that we may be going into a change. However, you know, these hints are not consistent around January 8th. We're just keeping our fingers crossed.
And so tell us what you're keeping your fingers crossed for, that this high ridge dissipates and storm will come in. What are the prospects for that, or is it just fingers crossed at this point?
Not quite fingers crossed. We have mathematical models that actually forecast future patterns, and some of these models occasionally show what I was describing earlier is a breakthrough in which we get a branch of the storm track coming from north of Hawaii into California. However, it's been very inconsistent signal. Some of them are very dramatic. It can happen. It's happened in the past where we've gone from extreme drought to lots of precipitation. But frankly, there's been no consistency that allows meteorologists to tell the public, hey, be optimistic, we are going to start to get rain. However,
yeah,
the signal is there around January the 8th.
And do you have signals, Professor Monteverdi, that extend beyond that? In other words, beyond this prospect of January 8th, any indicators of what lies ahead, or is the best guess that this will be a pretty dry winter?
You know, the National Weather Service has actually done some studies on that just based on statistical analysis. And believe it or not, usually when we've had such a dry fall, it sometimes reverses. That doesn't mean we end up with a normal year, but at least we get enough precipitation to help out the water resource issues that was mentioned, that were mentioned by one of the other speakers here. So, but no, we cannot make that kind of what we call deterministic forecast for the winter. Right now, it does look like January is going to be drier than normal, but that doesn't mean no precipitation, which is what's been happening. And then beyond that, it just looks like the call from the Climate Prediction Center is for the best chance of a normal rest of the winter. But right now, nothing in the offing for sure.
John Monteverdi, professor of meteorology in the Department of Earth and Climate Sciences at San Francisco State University. Thanks so much for adding your perspective to our discussion this
You're
morning.
You're welcome.
So let's get a sense of where we are and the depth of the concern, air and then water. Lisa Fasano, what's been the biggest concern so far that have mandated these Spare the Air days? What's the nature of the problem that you're trying to make sure doesn't get worse for people who live in this area?
Well, the issue for us is unhealthy air. When we have this inversion layer, which basically caps the air in our region, it traps all of the pollution that we produce on a daily basis. And we know in the winter that the largest source of our wintertime pollution is from wood smoke. That's about 30% to 40%. So it's like someone smoking in a restaurant or a table of smokers in the restaurant. The rest of the restaurant is impacted, even though there's one table off to the corner that's smoking. And that's what happens when people burn in their fireplaces. You know, a few fireplaces burning can impact the neighborhood or a region, and that's what's happening. It just sort of sits there.
When I read that last night, I was so surprised, actually, because that's really a bigger source of air pollution than how many people are out driving on the highways. And that, to me at least, is quite surprising.
Yes, that is correct. I mean, it is a big number. And it's because, you know, fireplaces are essentially unregulated sources of pollution. And they don't have any pollution controls on them or anything like that. It's just putting a lot of smoke straight out into the air. And when it's trapping it there, it puts it straight out into your backyard, your neighbor's backyard, out on the street where children play. Creates very unhealthy air for all of us, specifically right in the area where we're all walking and breathing.
You just said up to now. Does that mean that there may be some regulation of wood smoke in the future? If so, what would that be? Where would that come from?
Well, the regulation is the wood smoke rule that we put in place. I don't know that there's any devices as of yet that you could put on a chimney that would actually help to reduce the pollution. But there certainly are other devices that people can avail themselves of that can help reduce the amount of pollution that's put out by their chimney.
And what is it actually, Eric Stevenson, that's in the air that's not good for you? What is it that comes out of your chimney that is something that is of danger to people if it gets to be too excessive?
Well, when we burn wood smoke, it produces particulate matter, and that's little pieces of solid product. And this particular particulate matter is very small, 2.5 microns or less, and it's able to get deep into your lungs, bypass your natural defenses, and wreak havoc in your lungs. And some of the particles are so small that they can actually pass into your blood and cause damage to other organs within your body.
Would you rather just have people not burn no matter what? I mean, let's say today. I mean, today is you're good to go. I could go home this evening and build a fire in my fireplace. But would you rather me not?
Ideally, yes, that's exactly right. Wood burning is not a very efficient way of heating your home. There are much more efficient ways. And, you know, as Lisa pointed out, there's no real technology that's available on your normal fireplace that reduces that particulate level down to a level that we would consider safe or without risk.
You know, it's also important to note that even when you burn in your fireplace, even if you have a well-vented chimney, we know that about 10 to 15% of that particulate pollution is entering into your home. And your doors and windows are usually closed up in the wintertime. And so you're just filling your home with that unhealthy air, the unhealthy particulate. And, you know, during this season when you've got, you know, guests and relatives over, you're just creating an unhealthy environment in the home, and we don't want to see that as well. But we certainly need to regulate what's happening outside.
And let's turn back to and fold water back into this conversation, Jeanine Jones, in terms of what you want people to do, even though in the Bay Area, at least right now, there aren't mandatory measures in place. Does the same sort of thinking apply, just as I would be really a better citizen if I didn't start a fire in my fireplace tonight? Would I also be a better citizen if I started really minding my water usage?
And one of the easiest things that people can do, and so many people fail to do, is to turn off their sprinklers during the wintertime. You do not need to be watering your lawn or your landscaping three times a week in the middle of winter. It's not necessary. And when you think about perhaps redoing your landscaping, look at the drought-tolerant plants that are available and think about using those instead of, for example, just replanting a lawn.
We'll invite other suggestions on water conservation throughout the hour. So thanks for getting us started on that. And if listeners have ideas about that, we would welcome their thoughts and contributions, too. We'll get our phone lines going in just a sec. Here's the number if you want to join our conversation. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. But also, Jeanine Jones, tell us what's going on in terms of the management of this and the planning that's going on, because you're the deputy drought manager for the state and are also engaged with the task force that's making plans for this. There have been some requests from U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein to the governor's office that a drought emergency be declared. What's going on with that right now? What's the planning that's taking place? And is that declaration imminent?
Okay. Well, first of all, recognizing that we have had dry conditions, the governor issued an executive order in May regarding expediting water transfers, directing the Department of Water Resources and the State Water Resources Control Board to do things like streamlining the contracting process for water transfers that would take water from Northern California, the Sacramento Valley, across the Delta and to the agricultural users in the San Joaquin Valley in Southern California. So work has been going on in that regard already, many meetings with the water transfer buyers and sellers, and with the agencies to develop a common agreement on a schedule for processing transfers and expedited ways of doing the contracting. As you pointed out, the governor has named his interagency drought management task force, which will be meeting this week. And at this point in the game, one of the things we're really looking at, though, is what's going on in the Sierra Nevada, specifically with the snowpack. Our first formal snow survey of the season will take place this Friday, and the snowmelt runoff forecasts that follow from that will be available about a week or so after that. We know that this initial survey will be pretty scarce, because if you were to, you know, be flying in an airplane over the Sierra now and look out the windows, you would see not a lot of white stuff on the ground there. But by the time we have the February snow survey results in hand, that's really when you make the call about which way the water year is going. And as our meteorologist alluded to, it looks like we may see a little change in the pattern next week, so we're hopeful. Keep in mind that on average, about half of California's precipitation occurs in the months of December, January, and February. So we essentially have to write off January as missing, December as missing, but, you know, Mother Nature can often throw us a curveball, and as was mentioned, it's very hard to predict what February and March will bring.
Jeanine Jones, the Interstate Resources Manager for the California Department of Water Resources. Lisa Fasano, do we need to just change our thinking, regardless of whether today is a good day? There's this tendency to think, okay, good, the wind's blowing, might have a storm on January 8th, we're good to go. Do we really just need to come to terms with the impact of climate change and everything else and really live differently, whether that's how we burn or how we consume water?
Absolutely. You know, when the Air District was first started in 1955, one of the first rules that we put in place was a rule against backyard garbage burning, because back then in 1955, everyone burned their trash in their backyard and we had a horrible pollution problem. And there was a lot of outcry from the public then. And it didn't take long after we put a rule in place banning backyard garbage burning for people to recognize that the air was actually getting cleaner and they were able to breathe easier. And we're coming to that point again now where using wood to heat your home just really is inefficient, and it pollutes our region. And with 1.4 million fireplaces and 7 million residents in the Bay Area, we need to be more mindful of the airspace that we all share and find other ways or alternate ways to heat our homes.
Let's start taking a couple of calls on our topic this morning. And Steve is going to get us going first. Steve, go ahead, please.
Yes, hi. My question is about the history of using wood fires to heat our homes and for cooking. I'm wondering what the effect was on people's health at a time when that was more popular, was the only way that people heated their homes.
Steve, thanks for the question. And we actually have someone just joining us now who may be able to answer exactly that. And that's Sri Prasad, who is a physician in the Department of Pulmonology with Kaiser. Dr. Prasad, thanks for joining us.
Hello, good morning. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you participate in our program. Steve's question is what do we know about this over time, about the health dangers of wood burning in particular? Can you help us out?
Well, the incomplete or combustion of any fuel substrate or any fuel source leads to the formation of fine particulate matters. So what happens is pure fuels, like high-octane fuels, combust completely the carbon dioxide and water. But fine particulate matters have other substances in them. And as a consequence, when these fuels are burned, they may contain sulfates, they may contain nitrogen-containing compounds. So those don't combust completely into carbon dioxide and water. They combust into fine particulate matters that are a few microns in size, as opposed to atomic level size molecules.
And
so
what are these? Sorry, go ahead.
So these fine particulate matter fragments are a few microns in size, so they're several thousand times larger than a single atom. And what happens is as they absorb into the lungs, one of the earlier speakers was talking about how the fine particulate matters enter the bloodstream, and they travel through the bloodstream and terminate in the coronary arteries and in the lungs. And as a consequence, they elicit both short-term and long-term damage to the heart and to the lungs.
So it's not just, in this case, people who may have a history of respiratory problems or asthma who need to be concerned about this? It's people who might have heart concerns as well?
Very much so. In fact, some of the most sophisticated work on this was done in Boston, and there's a fine particulate matter monitoring station in South Boston. So the group there at Harvard collected something like 17,000 data points looking at fine particulate matter levels in the air from hour to hour and correlated that with surges in admissions to the hospital with coronary disease and coronary events. So people with chronic coronary disease, for example, were much more likely to go to the hospital with an acute heart attack 6 to 8 hours following a surge in the fine particulate matter levels. So it's not by any means just lung disease. There's very good evidence that in the acute term, in the short term, acute exposures to surges in fine particulate matter levels leads to some irritability of the coronary vessels, and then from there, coronary occlusion and followed by heart attack. So there's a pretty good causal chain correlating these two.
Dr. Sri Prasad joining us. He's a physician in the Department of Pulmonology at Kaiser. Dr. Prasad, can you stay with us for a few moments more?
Of course.
All right.
Of course.
When we come back, we're going to take a short break. We'll explore this a little bit more and learn more about who's at danger in these situations where we have bad air that has been so much the norm, unfortunately, in the Bay Area recently. We'll explore that as well as what else can be done to improve our air quality and what can be done perhaps to conserve water given the dry winter that we have had to date. Here's the numbers if you want to join us. You can call us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. If you have questions about air quality or about our water situation in California, you can email us at forum@kqed.org, or you can post your thoughts or questions on our Facebook page or on our website. I'm Dave Iverson, in for Michael Krasny today. This is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson in today for Michael Krasny. Our topic today, what our situation is right now with air quality in the Bay Area and what our situation is with water. What is going to happen over the course of this winter and the summer ahead for both of those areas of concern? We're joined by Lisa Fasano and Eric Stevenson of the Bay Area Air District. Janine Jones is here as well from the California Department of Water Resources. And Dr. Sri Prasad joins us too. He is a physician with the Department of Pulmonology at Kaiser. And before the break, Dr. Prasad, you were outlining some of who is at risk. And I guess the question that I wanted to follow up with, does that mean that someone who has perhaps some heart concerns or someone certainly who has asthma or a history of that sort of respiratory problem, does that mean they just should not have any kind of fireplace or use a fireplace in their home?
Well, I think that wood burning and wood burning fireplaces are very problematic, particularly for people with asthma. Not only is there good evidence that wood smoke and particulates from wood smoke can precipitate asthma attacks, they can also make the underlying lung tissue more inflamed and therefore more brittle. So most diseases like asthma are diseases characterized as multiple hit diseases. So it's no one exposure that makes a person have an asthma attack. It's usually several exposures in sequence, and the final exposure is the one that makes them have a particularly severe attack. So long-term exposure to wood smoke means that they need one fewer or two fewer hits before they have an attack. So they make their asthma somewhat more brittle to control. The same thing is probably true for coronary disease as well. Chronic coronary disease that may be structurally significant but may not react and develop acute obstruction of the coronary arteries unless there's multiple hits that precipitate that, and wood smoke may be one of those hits that precipitates that that final occlusion that leads to an acute heart attack. So I would say that that's true. People with chronic lung disease, particularly chronic lung disease, I advise them not to keep a fireplace, and if they have one, not to use it, because I think that is certainly one of the things that can precipitate attacks.
And just one last question. For someone who is having these difficulties on spare the air designated days, what's the best thing to do? Do you stay inside? Is inside air better? What do you do if you are confronted with this ongoing series of spare the air days as we've had recently?
Unfortunately, inside air and outside air, it's not clear that the inside air is going to be markedly cleaner or more pure than the outside air. Air does circulate very quickly. So in those situations, when somebody has chronic lung disease for certain, I would advise that they have their bronchodilator on hand, and that's their inhaler that they use to rescue them from acute attacks. So I would advise them to have that on hand. And for people with chronic heart disease or coronary disease, to be aware that those are the days that they may be prone to having coronary symptoms, such as acute chest pain or chest tightness or chest heaviness during spare the air days, not to take those symptoms lightly.
Yeah. Dr. Sri Prasad, physician with the Department of Pulmonology at Kaiser. Dr. Prasad, thanks a lot for adding your expertise to our discussion this morning. Appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
And let's go back to our calls and hear more about what people's concerns are and also what we can do. What are the things that people can do, both in terms of improving air quality on an individual basis, as well as being mindful of the kinds of water conservation steps we need to take too. Hank joins us next in Oakland. Hank, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. One question, and it's both health and the air quality. What about all those wood-fired pizza restaurants? Do they have to curb their burning? And is it dangerous for your health to sit in one of those restaurants?
Hank, thank you. Eric?
Well, I think as far as the regulation goes, we don't regulate wood burning when it deals with food. Of course, you know, the restaurants have good ventilation. They're less likely to be as tight as, say, your house is. So it's something that we're going to consider for the future. But at this point, wood burning associated with food cooking is not regulated.
It's an interesting question, though, that Hank raises, because you're regulating kind of half the problem in a sense, right, Lisa? I mean, if you can exist with rules, if people have to exist with rules that enforce them in the home, it doesn't make a lot of sense that you would then drive down the block and have dinner at a wood-fired pizza place.
Well, the decision was made back when the rule was established to exempt wood fires for cooking, primarily because there wasn't as many of those types of wood fires in the Bay Area. There was many, many more home fireplaces. But certainly when you go into a restaurant that does cook by wood fire, you can smell it. And so there are impacts there as well. Fortunately, there's just not as many of them as there are household fireplaces.
A couple of people also want to raise this question as it relates to outside barbecues. One person writes, my neighbor next door was barbecuing on Christmas Day when it was the Spare the Air Day. I didn't want to tell them they were doing anything illegal. Well, I guess they weren't doing anything illegal, actually. So you can barbecue on a Spare the Air Day?
That's correct.
So what is that? What and this person also wants to know whether or not they could report them. In this case, of course, they wouldn't have been doing anything illegal. But can people report? Can they report anonymously? What's the whole enforcement procedure?
Absolutely. People can report, and they can report anonymously. And they can always call and just ask the question, my neighbor appears to be smoking food or barbecuing. Is that allowed or okay? And we've got folks who can talk to them about that. But they can call if they have questions or if they want to make a report to 877-4-NO-BURN. That'll go directly to the Air District. That's 877-466-2876, and that's how they can make a wood smoke report.
To James now in Nevada City this morning. James, go ahead.
Hi. My comment was regarding types of fireplaces. You seem to talk about them as if they're all the same. An open hearth fireplace is just a ridiculous nightmare. The efficiency ranges between minus 10 and plus 10 or so percent, plus smoke enters your room and so on. But the UL Type 2 wood-burning stoves are much better. And as far as restaurants using, making smoke, like in Marin County, Marin Joe's restaurant, they have to put in a re-burner up the chimney from their big charcoal barbecuing operation that actually re-burns the smoke. That cost them about $50,000. But my point mainly was that there's a huge variation between types of fireplaces.
Yep. James, thank you. Eric, why don't you take that?
Well, the caller's correct. There are huge differences in devices out there. There's EPA-certified devices, pellet stoves, that are much, much more efficient. One of the things that's critical to—
Efficient – sorry to interrupt, but efficient in terms of the amount of heat that you get or efficient in terms of the amount of air pollution they generate?
The simple answer to that question is yes, both ways. It's much more efficient in the heat that it produces, and because it burns much more efficiently, the emissions that come out of it are much cleaner, much more thoroughly burned. For the other part of that question, you know, that these devices are much more efficient.
Lisa.
But the point is that when we put the rule in place, they do still put out particulate matter. And when we were looking at, you know, up to 40% of our wintertime problem coming from particulate, we wanted to try to reduce all the particulate that was in the area, which would include these devices. In the Sacramento region, they took a different tact. They had a staged burning, no burning program where they would exempt EPA certified devices during certain phases. But even in this last spate of winter Spare the Air alerts that we've had, they've had a full ban on all of their devices, which includes these cleaner burning stoves, because the problem is so difficult right now.
Jeanine Jones, let's fold water into our overall conversation here too, because these problems are in so many ways connected. You mentioned earlier sort of one basic thing people can do is forget about keeping your lawn green during the winter. It's not really necessary to keep your water irrigation system going. What are some other things that people right now really ought to be paying attention to?
Well, the other one I mentioned was, and an easy one, is if you're thinking about changing your landscaping around, look for the water-efficient plantings. And if you have a large turf area in particular, think about possibly replacing some of that turf with something that is easy to care for but has lower water use.
Here's a comment that perhaps you can respond to. Jeanine Bobby writes in, I'm amazed at the lack of awareness around water conservation here in the United States. It's disappointing that the government officials fail to raise any alarms to conserve our natural resources. Well, of course, you are. A colleague told me the other day that her daughter takes the showers for an hour. When I told her that's irresponsible, she told me that that's what all her friends do, so forth and so on. Can you put these in kind of relative order, Jeanine Jones? Is an hour-long shower more damaging than watering your lawn twice a week? I mean, what are the sort of big consumers that we really ought to be most mindful of?
Well, you brought up a good point there that I wanted to touch on first, and that's the perception of water in different parts of the United States. If you're looking at people in the wetter eastern part of the U.S., it's a completely different mindset than people in the more arid west, where thoughts of conservation and drought are much more prevalent. So, for example, a few years ago when the Georgia area and Atlanta were in a major drought, it was almost like 1955 in the air quality example that was mentioned with respect to the lack of preparedness for it. But in terms of what hurts the most, back in the latter 1990s, there were laws that went in place regarding water-efficient plumbing fixtures required of new construction, and since then, many communities have been encouraging retrofit of existing showerheads, faucets, toilets, etc. So actually, the indoor plumbing, major gains have been made there, but that's why most water agencies are really focusing on the outside, because that is typically in most areas of the state where the majority of a home's water use occurs and where there are the biggest opportunities for efficiencies.
Jeanine Jones at the California Department of Water Resources. If you have thoughts or ideas about how to conserve water and preserve the air, you're welcome to join us at 866-733-6786. To Miriam, who joins us in Richmond this morning. Miriam, good morning.
Hi. Yeah, I was calling in about air issues. I was just finding it very frustrating to listen to all this talk about fireplaces. I live in El Sobrante, just which is technically part of Richmond, and you can climb up the trail and you can see smoke belching out of the refineries. Just 24 hours, it's blackens the air in some cases. There's a known cancer cluster relating to the Chevron Richmond refinery, and then if you look up the coast, you've got Rodeo, you've got Hercules. They're all refineries. So all along 80, if you drive up towards the Carquinez Bridge, the smoke is just belching out on the left side of the road. And this is an area where people tend to not have wood stoves. I mean, it's a relatively poor neighborhood.
Yeah. Thank you for raising this, Miriam. Lisa Fasano, on that point, I mean, are our eyes on the prize here? Are we focusing on something small when really, as Miriam is suggesting, the big problem is something from a much different source?
Well, fortunately, we are able to put a lot of controls on refineries. So we've got a huge number of air quality controls on all of the equipment that they have. They're also inspected regularly and monitored regularly, so we can see what's actually being put out of those facilities. And there's reporting mechanisms. So although it seems like they are a large source, and they certainly are not a small source in the region, in the winter months, they aren't the largest source of our particulate pollution problem.
Can you compare them, Eric Stevenson, just from a technical standpoint? Is one more what comes out of a Richmond oil refinery compared to, four people burning wood stoves in a neighborhood? I mean, how do you assess, or can we assess, the relative dangers or consequence of either?
Well, we do that by compiling what's known as emissions inventories, and that's how we compare different sources to each other. And if I remember correctly, the refineries are responsible for approximately 7% of the particulate matter emissions during wintertime, where winter wood stove or fireplaces are responsible for 35% to 40%. Mm. Now,
What about in Richmond? As Miriam was pointing out, there might not be many people with fireplaces. So is this where air is shared, and so even though you don't have fireplaces in your neighborhood, you still have to be concerned about that?
That's exactly right. Not only is the smoke from fireplaces shared throughout the Bay Area and moves around, but also those emissions from the refineries also, while impacting Richmond, impact the rest of the Bay Area.
Miriam, thanks for the call. Thanks for raising an important question as well. Let's go next to John in Calistoga. John, go ahead.
Oh, hi there. I'm calling because I am wondering, is there anything that a community can do to deal with a gentleman who runs an open pit barbecue business here? And this guy, I guess his barbecue is really great. I'm a vegetarian, so I don't really know. But he absolutely fills our neighborhood with thick blue smoke on an almost daily basis. And I have often, you know, long been concerned about that, but I haven't been able to, you know, find any way to deal with that in a respectable manner.
John, thank you. Lisa?
Yeah, this tends to be a problem. We hear from these barbecue facilities that are putting smoke out. And I would say to the caller that they could call 1-877-4-NO-BURN and talk to our folks, and we can send an inspector to actually look at what's happening in that area and talk to the owner.
But as I understood what you were saying before, if this is involved in food preparation and it's outdoors, then, you know, our John's kind of out of luck, right?
Possibly, but there might be other provisions that they could look at just to see how much smoke he's putting out and how much of an impact it is on neighbors. And there's always the possibility of a nuisance violation for something like this as well.
Okay, John, good luck. Thank you. Thank you for calling. A couple of interesting comments coming in that I want to read. David writes, China and Mexico take short-term steps during air quality emergencies, like closing refineries or telling people they can't drive. Why don't we take any short-term measures during air quality emergencies, like banning the use of leaf blowers or restricting the use of cars and trucks? Is it enough to just ask people not to burn wood? Keep coming back to this in some ways, Eric Stevenson, because I think it's just sort of counterintuitive that wood stoves would be more problematic than how many cars are on the 101.
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly understand the point there, and I think that's something that we'll investigate. But I think I can help give everybody kind of a feeling for how much of that problem is caused by burning in the fireplace. When we put a log in the fireplace and we light that on fire, and after it's burned, we clean up the ashes. That difference in weight between what you've put in the fireplace and those ashes have actually gone up your chimney. So that's how much you're putting in the air every time you light that fire. Now, on cars and things of that nature, we had talked about the efficiency of the burning of the fuels, correct? So you've got that much more efficient burning process. You've got emission control devices on there, and you're reducing the amount of pollution that's put out by those various sources.
So how does this switch over, Lisa, during the summer months when people obviously aren't burning wood, but they're still spared the air days? What's the different concern? And then, you know, we all know that we're not supposed to drive, though, of course, we all still do.
Right. There is confusion over driving in the winter versus driving in the summer months. The pollution that the cars put out or generate in the winter months is basically from road dust grinding over the roadways. But what's put out the tailpipe is not so much of an impact. However, in the summer months when we have high temperatures and sunlight, it mixes with what comes out of the tailpipe and creates smog, because it cooks up that pollution in the air and creates a different kind of pollutant. So that's the difference between how transportation impacts us in the winter months versus how it impacts us in the summer months.
So drive in the winter and don't drive in the summer, and don't burn wood stoves.
Well,
and we're good.
Carpool every day.
Janine Jones, I'm sorry to be neglecting the water part of this conversation. It's interesting to me that I've got a handful of emails sitting in front of me, and our phone lines are full, all with comments about fire. No one's calling in about water. So what do we need to be thinking about that apparently we're not?
Well, I think many people see the air quality issue as something that affects them personally right now, whereas in the water business, we tend to do a very good job of delivering water to people. They turn on the faucet, it's always there, not a problem, and it hasn't been dry long enough yet for it to start hitting home to people that they need to start thinking about the conservation message. One of the things that we at Department of Water Resources do is we partner with the Association of California Water Agencies in a Save Our Water public education campaign, and we develop all kinds of media materials, public service announcements, print media content that local agencies can use to help educate their customers. And I think if spring continues dry, we'll see a lot more of this hitting the airwaves and in print.
A couple of questions just came in as I was making that comment about not getting much in the way of reaction to the water issue. Sarah writes, I'd like to know how water restrictions will be applied. Enforced reductions in usage disproportionately affect those of us who already conserve. Will there be new approaches devised? So I guess the question in a sense, Janine, is can you focus your enforcement efforts on the big users who aren't conserving versus those who do?
Well, first of all, I need to start off by saying that each individual water supplier is responsible for determining how that supplier will implement conservation requirements, and how agencies do it can vary greatly depending on the size of agency, how many customers they have, where they're located. But something that many agencies are doing more and more of these days are what's called increasing block rates for water. So rather than paying a flat rate for water, customers pay a smaller amount for the first X amount of water, a larger amount for the next Y amount of water, and a much larger amount, let's say, for the Z amount of water next. And that is a recognition that it's not fair to punish those who already are using not much water and instead focus on the larger water users.
And back to our calls. Let's go to Peter next in Berkeley. Peter, go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for the program. I want to make a recommendation and ask a question about the water issue. There's a great book out there called Taking on Water by a woman named Wendy Pabich, and it's all about at least her experience in trying to reduce personal water consumptions.
Okay, thanks, Peter.
And my question is, can the card person recommend a website or someplace that people can go to find out what we're thinking about converting our fireplace into either an insert or something of that sort. And we're wondering, where can we go to find out what products or units are more efficient than others?
Okay, Peter, thank you. Any suggestions on where people can get that kind of information?
Well, we don't actually put information on our Spare the Air website, but I know that the EPA's BurnWise website has information about those kinds of devices. And so that might be a good place to start, where people can find out information about what might be the best type of device they could put in their home.
Peter, thank you. And I think our next caller actually has some advice, perhaps, to give you and others on that particular question. Alexa in Benicia, go ahead.
Yes. I found a beautiful solution. I have a romantic attachment to sitting in front of a fireplace from my childhood, but I'm also a very committed environmentalist. So when I remodeled my home, I was really in conflict. I wanted a fireplace. I felt guilty if I put one in. So I researched, and I found that there are now on the market literally hundreds of bioethanol fireplaces, fireplace inserts, and also gel fuel fireplaces that produce
Alicia,
only water vapor.
Yeah, Alicia, thank you for that. Eric Stevenson, can you verify that? Is Alexa being able to hold true to her environmental standards while also holding on to romance?
Yes, there are a number of options, and she pointed out quite a few of them.
But do those still, you were saying before that even these good, better, more efficient stoves still produce some particulate matter. Is that true for the bioethanol fireplaces that she was referencing?
They do have emissions. Anytime you burn anything, there are going to be some emissions. Now, the more efficient processes produce pretty much just CO2 and water.
So in the end, what you're saying, just to be blunt about this, if you really want to do a good deed, you would just you brick over your fireplace, right?
Well, yeah, you brick over your fireplace, or you convert it to something else that could be cleaner burning, certainly.
And to Kathleen next in Santa Rosa. Kathleen, go ahead.
Yes, I'd like to know what to do about a neighbor who's apparently lied to the Air Quality Control Board and told them they can't afford anything but fire, but just recently purchased two new cars and a new motorcycle.
Okay.
What can I do about that?
Kathleen, thank you. Yeah, Lisa?
We get a number of calls like these over the winter months, and we do send out specters, and we follow up with people who say that they have exemptions. People who claim that they have exemptions for a broken furnace only get it for a one-time seasonal period, but we do go out and follow up with them. So I would say that we would probably be following up at some point.
A couple of questions I want to get to real quickly. Johan writes, not to be a spoil sport, but could someone address fireworks and air pollution? Eric?
Well, that's a tough one. When we initially put this regulation in place, we were trying to get that low-hanging fruit of fireplaces, which has a huge impact. Fireworks, of course, do. Also, it's something that we're going to have to look into in the future so that we're not you know, telling people not to burn in their fireplaces and at the same time having huge fireworks out there.
And we've actually seen, we had an exceedance on July 4th several years ago from fireworks just from the Oakland A's Coliseum because of the fireworks they put out. So we do know that there's an impact there.
And Paul has this observation, which is, why don't you lift the burning ban when weather conditions change during the course of a day? I think the public would have more respect for the burning prohibitions if you would adjust those forecasts.
You know, when we were trying to set the forecasting and get this program going back in 2008, it was very difficult. We were initially calling it on the same day for that evening into the next morning. That was problematic because people were letting us know that they weren't able to find out in time whether or not they could burn or not. So we actually took a look at how we forecast. We backed it up a bit so we could give everyone at least 12 hours to notice before the ban was in place. So that we could help reduce. And so part of this is just how do you message this so that you can keep up with the forecast, but also let people know and give them enough time to prepare? And then how do you take into consideration when these weather conditions do change?
And Janine Jones, we just have a moment left, but is this sort of the new normal that in California we just have to make these things now, whether we're talking about, in this case, air quality or water conservation, that we need to take these steps now, really, and forever?
You know, I think it never hurts, at least particularly from a personal financial standpoint, to reduce your use of resources because then, you know, obviously as a consumer, it costs you less. But looking forward to a future with climate change in it, certainly the indications suggest that we should expect more variability and more challenges in the future.
Janine Jones from the Cal Department of Water Resources, thanks for being part of our program. Last thought, Lisa Fasano, on looking ahead, what's in store? When will you make your next decision about sparing the air?
Well, we're doing the forecast now, and we should have our forecast ready about 1 o'clock today, and we will be putting that out, and we'll see, you know, how the weather's holding and whether or not we're going to have to make another call.
All right. Let's all hope for wind and rain.
Absolutely.
Lisa Fasano, Eric Stevenson from the Bay Area Air District. Thanks very much for being part of our program.
Thank you so much.
We also were joined earlier by Sri Prasad at the Department of Pulmonology at Kaiser. We are thanks to him, as well as John Monteverdi, professor of meteorology at San Francisco State, and of course, Janine Jones at the California Department of Water Resources. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lorberg. Our engineer today is Jim Bennett. Dan Zoll is our senior editor. Amanda Supai, our engagement producer. I'm Dave Iverson, in for Michael Krasny. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.